Welcome to the Center for Internet Security's podcast, Cybersecurity Where You Are. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we are at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or even running a state or local government. Join CIS's Sean Atkinson and Tony Sager as they discuss trends and threats, ways to implement controls and infrastructure, explore best practices, and interview experts in the industry. We are here to bring clarity to these complex issues to bring confidence in the connected world.
Now, welcome back to our podcast from the Center for Internet Security, Cybersecurity, Where You Are. As usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Sean Atkinson, the CISO of CIS. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you, Tony.
And we're doing a part two with a guest with a really fascinating and relevant topic, John Cohen of the Center for Internet Security. Welcome back, John.
It's great to be back with you all.
Good to have you here. And so we wound up episode one of this conversation with you about your work at CIS and focused around, Sean had asked you a question about this whole of society thing. And you drift quite a bit on this, the notion of making the public resilient. And I thought it was just a wonderful phrase that captures the problem. Again, beyond the, I used to say in cybersecurity, I would say things like, you know, I grew up with smoking the bear, only you can prevent forest fires. But at the end of the day, that's an attention getter. But in Boy Scouts, we learned the five-step process or whatever it was for extinguishing your campfire safely, right? And you needed to have both. You needed to get attention, but you also needed to ask specific behaviors of people in order to achieve this state of resilience. So it feels like in cybersecurity, the IT sort of traditional model, we have a pretty good sense of what people ought to be held accountable for. We talked about that term cyber hygiene and sort of basic practices and so forth. But your world is a really more complex and nuanced world, right? What are the things we should be asking people to focus in on?
Yeah, great question. And I will caveat it by saying that what we need them to do is something that they will likely be most resistant to. Because if you think about why and how an information operation is designed to work, it is designed to work by exploiting one's confirmation bias, right? Everyone in our society has their beliefs. Increasingly, we've become a society where we're less willing to listen to the beliefs and accept the beliefs of others. And we're also a society where people are much more willing to not only vehemently oppose those with different ideas, but in some cases actually engage in violence to express their disagreement with people with different ideas. So our adversaries understand that. And when they design these information operations, they will develop the content specifically to resonate with a subset of people in our country because of their confirmation bias. They create the content those people want to hear. So the first thing you have to teach people is, particularly those people who get the majority of their information through social media or other online online forums, is that much of what they're seeing is inaccurate, and much of it's been put there specifically to influence their behavior. And that they, if they see a piece of content that makes them feel, you know, have a strong reaction to, they should go and look for accurate information that provides them the ground truth about the issue. So for example, if somebody hears from, or consumes some content that says that a Jewish space laser started the forest fires that were burning parts of California, or that the fires in Maui were part of a government plot to illegally take the property away from the homeowners on that island, causing them to resist evacuation orders when they were provided by local law enforcement and firefighters, and choosing to remain in their homes instead, putting themselves in jeopardy. When you see something like that online, you should go to a trusted source of information to see if it's accurate or not. That's the first lesson. That's the first way that people can make themselves less vulnerable or more resilient to these types of information operations. But again, you know, you've been in this business a long time. You and Sean both have. And, you know, the folks who are engaged in this type of activity, they're very sophisticated. I mean, they study our society. They understand the societal fractures. They understand those issues that cause a passionate response by people. They're looking to exploit the polarization of our society. And they are very good, and they've gotten even better through the use of artificial intelligence in developing content that's specifically intended to make people upset, right? In the hopes that they will take that reaction and they will again, it'll influence the way they vote. It'll influence the way they respond to government. It will influence the way that they respond at a very granular level with government requirements. And in some cases, it may even influence people to demonstrate, destroy property, and even commit mass shootings. So the first step in defense is for people to educate the public that what they're seeing online is very often put there purposely to cause a reaction. And in many cases, that information or that content's inaccurate.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you're creating factions through reactions in a lot of cases in order to create that separation and those elements in that space. And John, it leads me to, thinking about the underlying framework that's been developed and how is it used? And we've both in part one and as you've addressed now, we're looking at different attack strategies, right? The tactics, techniques, the protocols that are used. How does the national framework start to address and build capability in certain areas in terms of ultimately building resiliency and building intercommunication for organizations to address this in kind with a lot of respect?
Yeah, and I appreciate your use of the word faction, because as you may remember in our earlier conversation, you referenced the Federalist Papers, and it's Federalist Paper 10, I believe, where the founder warned, beware of factions, because they understood that factionalism is potentially a fatal underpinning for the republic. So, but you're absolutely right. And so when we looked at, to the gist of your question, when we looked at what was missing and what we needed in order to address this rapidly evolving threat environment, it really came down to four areas. The first was the lack of accurate, objective intelligence and analysis about the threat environment. And this is both at what I would say a very tactical level, as specific threats were emerging that may be time sensitive, but also as it relates to evolving threat trends. We just found that for a variety of reasons, government organizations that, and particularly those that operate in the unclassified space, like DHS, like the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, were just not producing a lot of useful information and intelligence that state and locals and non-government organizations could use to be better prepared to deal with the emerging threat environment. Related to that, but separate, we also found that information sharing on these threats was very lacking. That even when there was analysis that really hit the mark, it wasn't getting to the people who needed it. And in some cases, that was because some of the information systems that we had built after September 11th that were intended to facilitate federal, state, local information sharing had become old and obsolete and unused. But also, there was, going back to the conversation that we had previously, there was a lot of discussion at the federal level in particular as whether under their authorities, they would be, again, particularly DHS and the FBI, whether they would even be allowed to look at some of this information or these activities that were taking place online. The third area of focus for the framework has to do with what we were just discussing earlier, is how do you make society resilient? What are the types of public education programs or public education efforts and training that is necessary in order to make communities more resilient? It's interesting to me that communities, certain parts of our community at times are both the targets for information operations or for the nefarious activities, and then they are the victims of the results of these information operations or nefarious activities. So how do you begin to inform and educate the public about how they should look at content they view online and how they should make themselves more resilient to being vulnerable to being influenced, or less vulnerable to being influenced. And then finally is building capacity to deal with the results of this type of activity. You know, as more and more people lose confidence in government or key institutions, as more people, you know, are led to believe because of different types of cyber attacks and information operations that our key institutions can't maintain our quality of life. We're seeing today that more people are willing to engage in acts of violence targeting law enforcement officers or government officials or members of our community who are targeted because of their faith, their sexual identity or gender affiliation, their race, their role as being government officials, their political beliefs. And so there's a lot more that society can do or communities can do in order to detect those types of emerging, detect individuals who may be traveling down the path of violence or destructive activity and mitigate the harm that they can cause. Those are really the four areas. So it's analysis, understanding the threat, information sharing, making our communities more resilient, and building capacity at the state and local level so that they're able to mitigate emerging threats more effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John, one of the things that strikes me, again, you're part of the team here at the Center for Net Security, so you get to see and you've been around the IT, classical computer security kinds of stuff. And it seems like in that world, you know, we sort of know who the key partners are, right, and who you have to go after. But this world, again, is more nuanced. And you've named some of them. But, I mean, you know, we can point to an IT security industry, right, that you can mobilize and try to shape and so forth. What are the equivalents in this more complex and hybrid world?
Well, I think the stakeholders you just mentioned are a key part of it, but I also think it's state and local law enforcement. So it's people who are doing investigations. It's the counterintelligence community, the people who work, you know, across the country each and every day to, you know, protect our universities and our industry and our government institutions from having their most sensitive information, you know, exfiltrated or taken from them. It's community members, it's faith-based organizations, community groups. When it comes to the analysis of threat-related information, what we're really finding is that the analysis benefits from collaborative efforts between government and non-government organizations. There's a tremendous amount of really good research and analysis that's taking place in academic institutions, non-profit organizations, and even commercial entities, where they often will have more flexibility than government entities have with regard to looking at online activity. So they can detect threats more rapidly and get information about threats out more rapidly as well. I'll give you a good example. You know, you and I have talked about this before, but the listeners may remember that several months back, there was a water management facility in rural Pennsylvania that was targeted with a cyber attack. And the attackers, which it turns out were an Iranian-linked cyber collective, were able to penetrate the controller of this water management system. Now, once they penetrated that controller, they could have caused the system to release chemicals into the drinking water supply. They could have disrupted the drinking water supply. What did they do? They posted some anti-Israeli pro-Hamas symbology on the monitor of the controller. The way we discovered that was simultaneous to the images coming up on the controller is this hacking collective claimed responsibility on one of their internet forums and then began spreading on X, formerly Twitter, that a claim of responsibility for not only conducting the attack against that water management system, but 10 others across the country. And then as part of their messaging said that they were doing this in support of Hamas and that any entity that used a specific piece of Israeli technology would be subject potentially to attack by them as well. So I mean, the information that gave cybersecurity professionals much more insight into that incident and potentially future threats were acquired by researchers who were doing work on Iranian intelligence linked social media forms. And they picked up all of this intelligence because the entire cyber attack was meant to be an information operation. That's what I'm talking about, is how it's not so clear cut anymore. Because if you would have simply looked at this incident as a traditional cyber attack, it would have been viewed as, it was kind of minor. There was no damage done. Oh, they did a defacement of a web defacement in a sense. They put a skull and crossbones, an anti-Israeli narrative on our controller. No big deal. We'll update our firewall or whatever. But when you look at it from the perspective of, this is part of a concerted effort to undermine, to send two messages, actually. One, to undermine support for Israel. But secondly, to sort of send a more subtle message to the American public saying, oh, and by the way, we hacked into this water management system. We could have, and while we put, this message on the screen today, we could have dumped chemicals into your drinking water supply, or we could have disrupted, thereby undermining confidence in the water system as well. That was part of the intent. So that sort of gives you a good, so who are the stakeholders there? I would say it's the cybersecurity folks, it's the water management folks, it's EPA, it's law enforcement, it's the federal government. It's the public. So you can help them better understand that if there is a disruption in water, what it means. But I think that's a good example that sort of helps.
No, I think you're right. Again, without that context, right? And that context, the understanding of the actors, their intentions, and how it connects, and these broader objectives of undermining confidence in the population, right? Of just any distrust. Any thoughts? So you've done a lot over the last couple of years, but sort of feedback from the front lines, right? What are people really telling you? What do they see of value, and how are they reacting to the studies that you've done and the work that you've done?
So I think, if you look at the sort of the statements that were coming out of DHS and the FBI and even the intelligence community when talking about the worldwide threat, worldwide threats. It's difficult to say this without sounding sort of painting a nice picture of ourselves. But I think what you're hearing from the FBI director now and the head of CISA and the secretary of DHS is much more in line with what we've been saying now at CIS for well over a year and a half about the evolving threat environment. What I'm also hearing, particularly from our state and local partners, is what they find most helpful about what we produce from an information and analytic perspective is the speed in which we can produce something after an event occurs, the way we're forward-looking and talking about how the threat is evolving, and the way that we have been able to clearly, in a way, provide guidance on how it all fits together. I mean, it's really interesting to me because this really was not a part of our original objective. But as we became much more involved with state and local organizations, and working on expanding their understanding of the threat, and we naturally, just because of the nature of the threat, there was much more of a focus on cyber threats, particularly cyber threats that are targeting law enforcement organizations and state and local governments, whether it was cyber activity associated with Russia and their elections, their efforts to disrupt the election, or whether it was post the Hamas-Israeli conflict outbreak in October of last year, the targeting of state and local government systems. And what it has led to is almost an intense interest by a group of people who I would say a year ago were pretty much uninterested in cybersecurity for the most part, but police chiefs and sheriffs. We're seeing a lot more of them saying, well, wait a minute, if they're coming after us and doing all of these things, including cyber attacks, and they can take down my jail management system or my records management system or my 911 center with a denial of service attack, I better make sure my cyber house is in order. So on the one hand, while the Countering Hybrid Threat Program didn't start with this in mind, the unintended result has been a much more intense interest in not only cybersecurity broadly by these law enforcement executives, but in the types of capabilities that CIS and other providers can provide them in order to make sure their networks are secure. The other thing that we've really tried to focus on when we've done our analysis, and I think this is a little bit different, and this is certainly different than what my analysts did when I ran INA twice, is we don't look at online activity, whether it's cyber or information operations, just from the perspective of the strategy, right? We don't look at it just at a high level. We really try to pull from it information that gives us greater clarity on the targets that will be focused on by the adversaries and the techniques they will use to attack it. And that is incredibly helpful to particularly to state and local law enforcement and Homeland Security officials. They don't want to just know, hey, Al-Qaeda may try to conduct an attack over the holidays. They want to know, what are they going to target? What techniques are they going to use? How are they going to operationalize it so they can figure out ways to disrupt it? Whether it's through investigative, placing observations into context that they see, while they're doing their day-to-day jobs, or whether it's through some other type of activity. So, I said this in our first conversation, it's been really intriguing to watch the reliance that has now been formed on a non-government organization by government organizations who are now in many cases looking to us or the work that some similar organizations are doing, nonprofit organizations are doing, to inform their day-to-day operations for protecting their communities.
Absolutely. So, John, we've got the framework created. You've built it and created some of the recommendations, some of the findings through proof of concept initiatives, threat analyses, research, partnerships, strategic collaboration. What do you hope to see with this framework going forward?
Well, there's some work that I'd like to see we at CIS to continue. We've been working, my team of analysts have begun over the last 8 or 9 months to work very closely with the cyber threat intelligence team at CIS. I think we are producing some very unique analytic or unique analysis that is being viewed very helpful by state and locals and others. But I also would like to continue the conversation with government leaders at the national level, with state and local leaders, and other key stakeholders, because the framework lays out a broad range of activities. Some of them may fall into things that we do here at CIS, but quite frankly, most of them do not. But I think the role that a non-government, nonprofit organization like CIS can play, particularly one that has the expertise that resides within CIS, that's been built over the last several decades, I think maybe one of the best things that we can do is just to be, that facilitator and convener of thinkers, right? Bring people together to talk about the problems and then come up with, as we've talked about before, whole of society solutions. And then eventually, hopefully others will step up like we have to take on parts of this solution that needs to be in place in order to protect the nation from the evolving threats we face.
No, absolutely. I think it's vital work, John, because, the way I'm looking at it, and I'm just going to put a couple quotes in here just for thought as we wrap up is, we look at the National Cybersecurity Strategy of last year, looking at the next generation interconnectivity is collapsing the boundary between digital and physical worlds and exposing some of the most essential systems to disruption. And in that case, I do feel that there's kind of this call that the framework provides is the guidance in order to address these gaps and build resiliency. I don't know, John, at this point that there's necessarily a choice. We have to move forward and utilize the capabilities. Ultimately, the proof is kind of in the pudding, right? Of what you've provided is this sweet dessert for everybody to consume and for us to keep moving this forward as a as a national program in order to address certain elements. And the framework lays the foundation. And I, like you say, I think it's the call of others. I don't think this is a single entity's responsibility. It's really all of the stakeholders, all of those that have responsibility. And you even mentioned the individual within an infrastructure and organization having responsibility and accountability for their actions. And at this point, utilizing the work that you've demonstrated here certainly aligns to that, as we want to, one, bring awareness to certain situations, right? I think the use cases you mentioned, with water treatment and things of that nature have consequences that have necessarily, we think of cyber threat computer to computer, right? But now we're starting to see that this is a multi-dimensional threat landscape that cannot be thought of in such paradigms, as it were, that there is so many nuances to the approach with both the informational tactical approach and the, as we mentioned, factions from a reaction in a lot of cases in this space as well, is causing the consequence of us to rethink the approach. And just, John, if you've got kind of a minute, 2 minutes, just as your final thoughts in this space, with what we've discussed in both parts of our series here.
I've always been struck that I don't know if it's the motto or the mission statement for the Center for Internet Security. It's confidence in the connected world. But I'm struck by the fact that it's actually the connected world that may be undermining confidence in our society as a whole. And so as we look at the role of that the internet has come to play in many things that are wonderful about our culture and our society, we have to acknowledge that that same internet is being leveraged by those who seek to destroy our way of life or to achieve some illegal or nefarious purpose. So in a way, the best way that we can assure confidence in the connected world is to ensure that the connected world is a part the connected world is not allowed to undermine confidence in the rest of society. And so, when I started going down this road 2 years ago, I knew we would do something good. I knew we would do something that would have an impact. I knew that we could advance the ball to improve the safety and safeguard our communities across the country. But I thought that 2 years from now, I'd be having to talk to people like you and Tony and try to convince you, this may not really be, this is really important, but it may not really relate to what we've done in the past. What I've come to learn is that CIS is an organization that has dedicated itself to, as I said earlier, ensuring confidence in the connected world, but also ensuring safety, enhancing the safety for those who reside and work inside, the digital environment. And what I have come to believe is that we did do something important. We are helping to make our community safer. And it is a critical element of what CIS does as part of its core mission.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely concur, John. And again, thank you for all the work giving us this opportunity for this two-part series. I think we could have probably got 25 parts out of this series, but we'll bring it to conclusion, Tony, if that's all right with you, sir.
All right, John. I guess so. Sounds good.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, John. Thank you, Tony. Thank you to our listeners. Questions, comments, concerns, podcast@cisecurity.org. Make sure to subscribe in all the usual ways. And with that, thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the show today. The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS. If you're interested in learning more about how to grow your cybersecurity program, the free tools available to help you on your journey, or to get involved with the CIS volunteer community, visit our website, cisecurity.org. Start secure and stay secure.